This edition of the Monocle Arts Review was first broadcast on the 15th of October 2015 on Monocle 24. Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Matt Alagaya. This week saw the announcement of this year's Man Booker Prize winner, and so who better to join me than the person who's talked us through many of this year's nominees, Charmaine Lovegrove, co-founder of Dialogue Scouting. We'll be discussing this year's winner, Marlon James, as well as two new books, the latest novel by Margaret Atwood, The Heart Goes Last, and Matthew Green's look at the struggle to find peace amongst soldiers who have faced war zones in Aftershock, an untold story of surviving peace. That's all to come on the Monocle Arts Review. Stay tuned. Welcome to the show, Charmaine. This week, Jamaican author Marlon James was announced as the 2015 Man Booker Prize winner for his novel, A Brief History of Seven Killings. Charmaine, you reviewed this book for us a couple of months ago on the Monocle Arts Review. Did he deserve to win the prize?
Absolutely. You know, it's a fictional account of the attempted murder of Bob Marley in 1976 from multiple viewpoints. And I think there's 75 characters in this book. And I just think, anybody that's committed to writing such a tome deserves such a prestigious prize.
I mean, a lot of people mention this, the fact that there are that many, there's kind of this huge cast of characters, and the word polyphonic was used quite a lot. I mean, he takes on these different voices and he uses Jamaican patois and all that. I mean, was that one of the highlights for you, the fact that he has all these different voices in there?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, the prize is really about writing in English, and, you know, that's what the Booker Prize has come to be about. And I feel that this book shows English in all its many different forms, from kind of the Queen's English to patois and everything that's in between. And an island like Jamaica really characterises that love and passion for language and the many different types of people that speak English.
And James said in an interview last night, I heard, that that the award would mean, kind of, it would be a landmark for Jamaican authors, that they would be able to say, OK, now we can get international acclaim. Yeah, I mean, what for you do you think is the cultural significance of this book for Jamaica?
I mean, I just think it's huge. You know, a week ago, we just had Cameron talking about Jamaica and reparations and wanting to build a prison there. And, you know, the next week we have Marlon James winning the Booker Prize. And it firmly puts Jamaica on the map as being more than a place for ganja and reggae. And I think that that's really, really important, that the literary side and the lyrical side, you know, I thought it was really is coming out. And I thought it was really interesting that James said that Bob Marley and Peter Tosh, they really understood that, like, the voices from their mouths, from Jamaicans' mouths, is real poetry. And that really, really comes across in the writing. And I think it's really important for the island to be commended for that.
Excellent. I mean, the judges also said they reached an unanimous decision in less than 2 hours, apparently, which surely must be quite exceptional for the Booker.
Yeah, I mean, I saw a few of the judges during the week before, and, you know, their lips are tightly sealed and they hadn't made a decision. I think it must have been really exciting to kind of get into the room, having read all of the shortlist again, and everyone to say, yes, this is the book. And, you know, if you think that Marlon James was rejected 80 times for his first book, he may never have got there. So I really feel like it's a journey that we're all really grateful to have been on.
Yeah, I mean, he said that he almost gave up writing, I think 10 years ago or something. So it's kind of a good job that he didn't.
Absolutely.
Okay, so that was A Brief History of Seven Killings by Marlon James, and that was this year's Man Booker Prize winner. It's published by One World Publications. Let's move on now to the first of two new releases that you've picked for us this week, Charmaine. The Heart Goes Last is the latest novel by Margaret Atwood and explores some of the themes she's visited before, notably in the Mad Adam trilogy, such as economic and environmental decline, greed and corruption. Charmaine, talk us through the storyline here.
So, I mean, it's just a really crazy literary dystopian novel, and it's, you know, it's what we expect from Margaret Atwood. It's very comic in its tone as well, which is really important because it's almost sort of too close to the bone of how plausible this whole world is. So we're in the near future and we're plagued by, like, unemployment and housing shortages, and there's a lot of gangs on the street, and a young couple are forced to enter a social experiment where they have to live in a kind kind of sort of gated community slash prison, and then they alternate that between 1 month at their own home and 1 month in this kind of alternative reality compound. And during their time there, they, you know, they're working separately and their lives become quite separated, and they have to sort of try and find a way of coming back together whilst there's lots of affairs and there's a lot of doping and robotics and just like this really kind of madcap cacophony of weird and wonderful things, as I said, that we expect from Margaret Atwood brought together.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned, you know, cacophony. Do you think Margaret Atwood tries to do too much in this? I mean, it's almost like she tries to take on all of society's ills in one book.
Yeah, and I think that's a really important thing to try and do. You know, the book started as sort of mini stories in Byliner, the sort of online writing platform. And, you know, this is her 15th book and she's in her mid-70s now. And I just feel that with this, she's like, and everything can go in. And because of the comic tone and because of how scary the reality of the near future is, and I think actually when it comes together, it comes together as like an entertaining as well as like an expansive book that's very sort of expressive in its understanding of like the social and the real.
I mean, you said it's humorous and there are funny bits in it, definitely. Do you think it almost, in the end, it makes you feel, okay, we just need to make light of this, you know, terrible world we live in that's all going to hell in a handcart? Is that what it's saying, basically? Or is there a deeper message here that we need to be worried?
I think she's saying, like, be worried and watch yourself and, you know, be careful and think about tomorrow. But also, it's almost sort of existential in its understanding at the same time. You know, it's like you don't know what's going to happen and you don't know how these things are going to affect you. But what you do have to do is stay true to yourself and those that you love. And ultimately, that's what we're really kind of getting out of this book, is the kind of understanding that you only really have like yourself and those around you that you really care about to look out for you when really terrible things are happening.
So is that what the relationship between Stan and Charmaine, actually, as she's called, is that what that relationship offers us? It's sort of a slight silver lining.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think that's, you know, where as we get older and we start choosing our spouses and creating families, then we, you know, we have to make these really big decisions. And ultimately, we can't do anything about like the state of the world because it's a collective responsibility. So in individuals, you can only really make sure that you're doing your best and that you're doing your best by the people that are closest to you. And I really feel like that's what she's reminding us here in this book.
Okay, I mean, what is it that there's obviously this alternative world you mentioned, this kind of prison complex. For you, what did that tell us about our world? What's that trying to say?
I feel like it's really scary that you would live in this world where people are so, where you have to be protected by the outside. And so you're suddenly in this really bizarre compound where you're given these jobs that, you know, making like robotic sex toys and then farming. And I think ultimately, it's a really scary thing that really could happen. And it's kind of like a young people's old people's home. And it's just like, it okay. is like the most bizarre place that you can imagine. But somehow it feels like kind of comfortable and you can almost imagine yourself living there. And that's what I found, you know, it's kind of comforting in a way that this place might exist if it's going to shut out all the bad things that are happening on the outside. But then those things start to infiltrate and they start coming in and then they have to learn how to deal with that.
Okay, so it's kind of making us, you know, it's sort of warning us about our desire to make ourselves kind of insulated and
exactly.
from the outside world. Excellent. The Heart Goes Last by Margaret Atwood is published by Bloomsbury and is out now. Now, we're going to end the show with a bit of non-fiction now. Charmaine, Aftershock, an untold story of surviving peace by Matthew Green, talks about the difficulty of finding peace for soldiers who have faced war zones. Obviously, an important issue to tackle, but quite a difficult one too. I mean, tell us what you thought of this book.
I just thought this book was really amazing because it's something that we might know about, that people who have been serving in wars are really facing post-traumatic stress disorder, but unless you physically know somebody, then it's really hard to imagine what that really means. And I feel like I spend a lot of time reading fiction where I wonder what would happen to these soldiers in real life. And so it was really interesting to have this land on my doormat and to think about actually what happens in real life to soldiers once they've come from a war zone. So Matthew Green is a war correspondent for the FT and for Reuters, and he's been doing doing that for about 14 years. And he spent 2 years interviewing more than 100 veterans from conflicts stretching right back to Northern Ireland.
He's also interviewed people for, you know, nurses in the NHS and psychiatrists and psychologists. What kind of insights do they offer to this?
I think the main thing that categorizes this whole book is that it's just really misunderstood what like post-traumatic stress disorder is, and it's really misunderstood what soldiers are going through on a day-to-day basis. And you know, there was 2,264 people have come forward with mental health trauma from the armed services, which is like a 26% rise in 12 months, which is just phenomenal. And basically, you know, all of these healthcare professionals are just saying it's underfunded and we really need to help these people to go from the transition from conflict to peace. And I think that's a really, really important thing for us to all understand.
I mean, it does seem like every generation kind of has this moment where they look back at a conflict and realize what the sort of aftermath has actually been like for soldiers. I mean, you know, after the Vietnam War, I think in America there was a similar thing. Do you think Matthew Green is showing us a different side to war zones and war that we haven't seen before in these kind of past generations?
Yeah, well, I thought it was really interesting that like no British army officer has ever come forward to describe their issues around post-traumatic stress disorder. And so, you know, there's a lot of stigma around it in the army. And, you know, these men and women are going out and they're fighting for our country, and that, you know, they believe that they're fighting for our safety. Ultimately, they're coming back and they become like the most vulnerable people in our society. And there just seems to be like a really big disconnect. I think that this book allows us to think about their world from their perspective differently. And it is it's a different function of war. As I said, I'm always reading books that characterize war in fiction. But I've never really come across something like this that really tells the truth of war in this way.
That's interesting. I mean, how do you feel we end up thinking about the system as a whole? I mean, when you sort of take a step back from the book and then say, you know, what does this actually say about the system that these men are living in, men and women are living in?
It says to me that, you know, people are joining up for lots of different reasons, and many because they're kind of disillusioned with the life that they have in different parts of the country where there aren't enough opportunities. And then when they come back into civilian life, that it's a much greater issue. The issues that they left behind are kind of are constantly following them. Plus, they've got the added issue, a burden of what they've seen when they've been at war. And I just think that as a public, it's something that we're just really not aware of at all. And that's why I wanted to bring this book today, because I felt, you know, it's really important to have these really open discussions as we're talking about war and we're talking about warfare and what our government should be spending. And £7.4 million from the Ministry of Defence was put into mental health. But it's clear that we need a lot more money to kind of combat the disorders that happen after conflict.
I mean, it's interesting. There seems to be a kind of in wider society, a wider discourse about mental health now. I think people are being a bit more open, and people are talking about it a bit more than they used to, certainly. But do you think that kind of sort of post-war depression and mental issues have still been left kind of a little bit untouched?
Yeah, I think that there's a taboo because, you know, I think that these men and women are seen as like the strongest men and physically the strongest men and women in our society. And so then the depths in which they plummet through their depression is not really something that people would normally think about. And with Matthew Green, you know, he himself, after leaving Libya in 2011, suffered from a debilitating depression and really started thinking about, you know, how that affected him as a war correspondent. So what did that mean to soldiers? And so that's kind of the starting point of the book for him. And, you know, so that comes from someone's very real life experience. And I think that often these things have to come from someone's real life experience to give us the exposure to potentially really, life threatening mental illnesses.
I should just ask before we head off is, are these soldiers, have they been fighting in Iraq or Afghanistan? Which conflicts are we talking about?
Yeah, so all conflicts stretching back to Northern Ireland. And so there were 220,000 around servicing soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan. And so there's a growing number of cases specifically from those wars. And that's why it's gone up, 26% in the last 12 months of cases reporting on this. And we have to think about those who are not strong enough to come and feel the stigma and not able to come forward and speak to healthcare professionals.
That was Aftershock, an untold story of surviving peace by Matthew Green, and that's published by Portobello Books and is out now. And I'm afraid that brings us to the end of today's show. Charmaine Lovegrove, thanks very much for joining us as always. You've been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Matt Alagaya. My producers were Carlotta Rabello and Holly Fisher. Join us again at the same time tomorrow for our weekly film review with Karen Krizanovich. But for now, thanks very much for listening and goodbye.